standing on the lee of a rocky shore. A blonde woman lifted a wooden flute to her lips. Made of whalebone, the delicately carved musical instrument had been a parting gift from her father, just before Matt Pete threw her off a cliff. Leanna almost smiled at the memory. Oh, it was true that the old man had been crazy, yet he was also oddly wise and always gentle. It took years before Leanna could understand that her loving father had acted more insane than he really was to keep the Baron from taking her to his bed. Not a marriage bed, just the one he kept hidden from his wife in a stone shed behind the citadel, where nobody else could witness what happened to other young girls in the dark of a foggy night. Named Victoria by the Baron, but called Summer Leanna by her father, her first lesson in life had been that deception could be more useful than a knife. Matt Pete had taught the young girl many secret things in the privacy of their hut, patiently waiting until she became an adult of 18 winters, before casting her into the world to live free or die. It was cruel, but necessary. Frowning, the teenager redoubled her concentration, blocking out the bittersweet memories of her lost childhood and the fear stabs of hunger in her belly. Thrown into the sea wearing only the rawhide dress and soft slippers of a slave, Leanna now wore a warm robe made of moose hide and waterproof beaverskin boots. A grass rope was tied at her waist, and a large wooden knife was sheathed at her hip, with another tucked into her left boot. A spear rested in the dirt nearby. There was even a flat stone with a razor-sharp edge hidden under her rawhide dress in case of emergency, such as if somebody got a look at her eyes. A woven bag of river reeds hung across her back, bulging with everything she possessed, which sadly wasn't very much. Leanna forced her mind to relax, and the music flowed clear and sweet across the misty bay. The wind ruffled the long blonde hair hanging across her face, almost pushing it aside, but the lard she had carefully rubbed into the strands kept them in place. Since her birth, nobody had ever gotten a good look at her face, which was why she was still alive. Her eyes revealed the awful genetic truth, and throwbacks were slain on sight. Soon there was an answering tug in the back of her mind, and she almost smiled at the sight of a black snake rising to the surface and coming straight toward her. She stepped back slightly as she continued to play. The snake blindly charged her, going over the edge of the small pit and tumbling to the bottom. Startled, the snake lashed about, trying to get out, but the sides of the hole were much too steep. The snake eventually calmed, moving to the rhythm of the music, and then bizarrely fell asleep. Overjoyed, Leanna could not believe the sight. The song was working. Her father had been right once again. While he could see the future, she was able to command the lower animals. Wishing to test the range of her new ability, Leanna played on, using her mind to probe into the murky depths of the cold sea. After a while, she had found more snakes and several eels, a rare delicacy reserved purely for those of royal blood. What a feast she would have back in her little cave. Deciding that she could not wait that long, Leanna yanked the spear from the ground. Stabbing a particularly fat snake in the pit, she hauled it out, impaled. The dying creature thrashed for only a few seconds, then slumped and went still. Using her belt knife, she carefully peeled off the valuable skin and placed it aside, then scooped out the guts and tossed them into the weeds for the creatures of the field. Nothing bloody was ever allowed to fall into the lake, as that could summon a kraken, the most horrible creature in the world. Using a piece of flint and some dry grass, Leanna soon started a fire and fed the tiny blaze sticks, then branches, until it was a roaring campfire. Savoring the warmth, she stuck the snake on a green stick and put it over the flames, the delicious aroma of roasting meat a tantalizing torment. Leanna only vaguely sensed a movement from behind, when there was a terrible pain at the back of her head, and blackness filled the universe. She never quite fully lost consciousness, but she fell helpless to the ground. Leanna felt rough hands flipping her over. Dark shapes stood nearby. Her tongue felt thick, and the world kept spinning around.
Hot damn! Look, boy, she's a slut! Guess we got a meal and a ride!
Leanna blinked to try to clear her vision. The savage pounding at the back of her head made it difficult, but she ordered the pain away, and suddenly could see once more. There were 10 of them, large men with beards, wearing dirty robes of mismatched furs. Their hair was matted with sticks and mud, with grisly necklaces of dried human ears hanging around their throats. Each was heavily armed with stone weapons, knives and axes, and each carried a crossbow slung over a shoulder. Goddess protect her. These were Hillies. Kneeling alongside her, a red-headed man was binding her wrists with lengths of rawhide, while another cleaned the blood and hair off a boomerang on his sleeve. Dimly, she recognized it as her own blonde hair, and cursed herself for a fool, struck from behind. Hunger had distracted her for a few minutes, and now she would have to pay the ultimate price. She tried to resist, and the cold edge of a stone knife was pressed against her throat.
You stop wiggling, or I'll gut you like a fish, and that won't kill you, but you'll sure wish it had, you savvy.
Lyanna nodded her understanding, her mind racing to find some way to get loose, get free, escape. But if she struggled too hard, it might show them the truth, and death would swiftly follow. Finished binding her wrists, the Hilly began running his hands over her clothing, taking away everything in her pockets, and then cutting away the rope belt to spread open her coat. Shivering from the rush of cold air, Lyanna felt sick at the leering faces looking down at her.
Hey, looky there! Bitch's got a whole pit full of snakes! How the fuck did she do that without a net? Don't know, don't care. Ask her after we're done, but I want to start pumping right now. Wait your turn, Glebe. Now strip the bitch and make sure she ain't hiding a blade. We already know what she's hiding.
Trying not to burst into tears, Lyanna winced as the stone knife slashed away her clothing, soon leaving her exposed on the cold, hard ground. Filthy hands fondled her as the last of her clothing was removed. Then the Hillies jerked away, as if she had suddenly become red hot.
Well, nuke me. Looks like we got us a runaway slave. That's the mark for Anchorville. The Baron there will pay a fortune in steel for this little bitch.
I am a singer. I can summon snakes all you want at any time. I'll be a good slave for you. Your vill will never go hungry again, but don't send me back, please.
The faces of the Hillies underwent a variety of expressions as they considered the matter.
Nah, we got enough food. Grab her legs, boys! I'm going in!
Lyanna knew that her only escape would be death. So be it. She could at least rob the bastards of their fun. She shook her head as hard as she could, and her long bangs shifted away from her eyes. And the Hillies recoiled in horror. Sloshing out of the ocean, the cresting waves knocking them forward, the bedraggled companions staggered onto the shore, drawing their weapons. Weakly, shuffling behind some boulders for cover, the friends caught their breath as a second droid rolled off the balcony of the warship and plummeted into the water, vanishing beneath the surface. A few moments later, a boiling geyser erupted upward, only to come back down to spread outward as a warm and gentle rain.
Triple stoops. If that keeps up, there'll soon be no more droids on the bastard ship.
The bastard comps must have gone haywire over the decades.
Personally, I was thankful for the wash. I was starting to name my flies.
We need a fire right away or we're gonna get sick. There's enough driftwood about, but this wind is going to chill us eventually.
Just then, another droid rolled off the ship, the machine still in hot pursuit of the invaders.
Okay, these things aren't going to be troubling us any. Let's get into the forest and find some bastard shelter before we freeze solid.
Shelter and coffee.
Jack caught a movement in the air and smiled.
A bat. There we go.
Spinning, he strode toward the nearby cliff, and there it was. A large opening in the side of the rock formation. Signaling the others, the teenager drew his butane lighter and carefully proceeded inside. The cave ended after 100 feet or so, narrowing into a crevice too small for anything larger than a mouse to traverse. Obviously, the bat had not come from this particular cave. Fair enough. With all of those boulders outside, the cliffs were probably honeycombed with caves and tunnels.
Dear God, it feels good to get out of the wind.
Any occupants in here, Jack?
We alone.
Looks fine. Good job, Jack.
Easy to find a cave, if you know how.
Well, I'll cook dinner if somebody else gets the firewood.
We better find something to block the mouth first. Let's try to roll one of the small boulders in to help block the wind.
And keep in the heat. If we... Wait.
Something wrong, lover?
Her hair flexing in a wild corona, Christy said nothing as she looked around the cave, then suddenly lurched back outside with a drawn pistol in her hand.
Christy?
The woman gave no reply, lost in a private world. Just for a second, there had been a flutter in her mind. Screwing her eyelids shut, she blocked out the distractions of the world, the sound of the ocean, the cold wind, even the voices of her friends, concentrating solely on the ghostly sensation. But strain as she might, nothing more could be felt. The cry came from the direction of a low dune. Surging into action, Christy pelted in that direction. Whatever was happening, that had not been a cry of surprise or gladness. A steep embankment formed a dune that sloped upward to a grassy plateau. Christy took it at a run, breathing hard as she reached the top. A split second later, Ryan and the others arrived, staying quiet and letting her take the lead. Hesitantly, Christy moved forward, a gun in each hand. The area was thick with scraggy grass, along with tall reeds. To the left was the forest of pine trees, the air sweet with their scent. That seemed a logical place for somebody to make camp, but the cry had come from the right, so she raced back toward the lake. Redoubling their speed, the companions crested a low rise to come upon a small clearing filled with hairy men surrounding a blonde woman holding them at bay with a fishing spear. She was completely naked, her body covered with bruises, but the men were slashed in a dozen places, blood trickling from shallow cuts in their fur coats. Her wrists were lashed together in front of her, but the men seemed to be getting the worst of the fight. One big man had missing teeth, his jaw still dripping blood, another had a broken nose, and a third was missing a large patch of hair, his scalp oozing a clear fluid. Spotting the companions, the blonde smiled in obvious relief. Then her expression darkened.
Run! Run for your lives!
Hesitantly glancing backward, unsure if this was a trick of some kind, the hairy men recoiled at the sight of the companions, then grabbed up their dropped weapons.
Shuck man! Chill 'em, boys!
A Coldheart whipped his boomerang forward. Spinning across the campsite, the edge of the wooden boomerang glinted with sharp pieces of glass, and it parted the reeds at throat level, leaving a clear path behind. But the companions were already gone, ducking among the weeds and bushes. Instinctively, they expected to hear the crackle of gunfire, but there only came another boomerang, closely followed by a spear. But the barrage did nothing, not even coming close to the crouching companions. Encouraged by that, Mildred stood and fired her ZKR at two of the Coldhearts, killing them instantly. Hauling up his stire, Ryan shot two of the men dead before he had to take cover again, as another boomerang cut through the reeds. Appearing from behind a tree, JB fired the shotgun. Catching the blast full in the chest, a Coldheart went sailing off the cliff to disappear below.
Did you see that? Did you?
By the sky gods! They have blasters! Working blasters!
Get that steel!
Standing, Doc leveled the Ruger, the 357 Magnum bellowing smoke and flame. Two of the Coldhearts fell with gaping wounds in their chests. Liana jerked her attention back to the fight. Biting a lip, she shoved her hands toward the rocks forming a circle around the campfire and began to saw her bonds back and forth along the rough edge of a jagged stone. The heat from the fire was almost intolerable, but she kept doggedly at the action until the rawhide strips parted and fell away.
Hey!
A Coldheart turned fast, but as he looked her way, she threw the fishing spear. The Coldheart dropped his weapons to grab the wooden shaft, obscenely jutting from the ruin of his manhood.
You fucking bitch!
The leader threw a boomerang at Liana. Oddly, it came apart in mid-flight to reveal that it was actually two pieces. Desperately trying to get out of the way, Liana managed to avoid one of the sections, but the other caught her in the forehead. She slumped to the dirt, feebly twitching. With the blonde out of the line of fire, JB leveled the Uzi. The shocked Coldhearts were torn to pieces. Moving forward fast and low, the companions swept across the bloody campsite. While Ryan and JB stood guard over the campsite, Jack and Christy gathered firewood and dumped an armload of loose sticks onto the dying campfire. The dully glowing embers pulsed into life and rapidly built into a roaring blaze. Mildred knelt alongside the unconscious woman to check for any serious damage. Thankfully, she seemed fine, just undernourished, and with a knot on her head that was going to be very tender for quite a long time.
How is she doing?
She'll be fine. Just battered and bruised.
They not ride her?
No, thank God. Looks like we got here just in time.
Glad about that.
The filthy blackguards. They perished too quickly for my taste in justice. A nice long hanging would have been their reward back in Vermont.
Duck started to remove his damp frock coat, but then he paused and instead kicked over the body of the largest Coldheart to strip the corpse of its much drier furs. He draped them over the woman, covering her naked body.
Looks like they ambushed her while cooking dinner. Guess she forgot to rig a trip line.
Stupid place for a campsite anyway.
Wonder if this was her first time outside of Ville.
Even then, she held off 10 Coldhearts all by herself. Naked and alone, she fought 10 men. She may not be very experienced, but she's got guts.
Mighty tough lady.
Ryan scowled and kicked away a snake, wriggling across the ground. That was when the pit caught his attention, and Ryan strode over for a closer examination. The hole was only a few feet deep, but absolutely jammed full of live snakes. He looked around for a net, but there were none in sight. Then he saw something in the grass. And lifted a small bone flute into view.
She a singer?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised. I heard her in my mind back in the cave. That's how I knew to come here.
She asked for help?
Not in actual words, no. It was more like a feeling of desperate need.
Ryan tossed her the flute, and Christy tucked it into a pocket for safekeeping.
All right. Let's get my patient off this exposed butte and back into our cave. I want to get some broth in her as soon as... What the hell?
Mildred kicked away a snake that had been circling around her boots, a water moccasin. The deadly snake went sailing to land a few yards away, but immediately went straight back toward Mildred.
Don't let it bite!
Jack threw a knife. In the act of rising for a strike, the snake was beheaded and dropped limply to the ground. But even as it died, several additional snakes came out of the reeds. Most were harmless black snakes, but mixed among them were several larger varieties that shook rattles or brandished long fangs that glistened with venom.
What the fuck?
Snakes never attacked in groups, but more of the creatures kept coming, completely cutting off any possible route to the mainland. Maintaining a steady barrage, the companions killed the deadly snakes, while the harmless black snakes circled their boots to converge on the unconscious woman. They crawled over her, trying to get between her and the companions.
Dark night. They're here for her.
But she asleep.
Tell them that.
Fire blast. I've had it with these motherfucking snakes on... Mildred, wake her up or blow her brains out.
Dropping to her knees, Mildred grabbed the girl by the shoulders and shook hard.
Wake up! We're friends! The cold hags are dead! Call off your snakes!
Liana looked around in confusion. Instantly understanding the situation, she tried to summon the strength needed for a song, but the pain in her head swelled in response. She fell once more into a pool of deep black. Rolling to the edge of the battle station, the last Guardian droid paused, then decided to go no farther. It would stay with the ship. The military programming inside the core CPU reacted strongly to that, but buried under the millions of lines of code coursing through the memory banks, the ancient original command of self-preservation surged to overwhelm the hastily written dictates of the U.S. Navy High Command. Pursuit had failed to apprehend the invaders. Now it would assume a passive role and wait. Liana awoke to find herself inside a small cave. Five strangers, two of them women, were sitting around a low campfire, their hands full of plates piled with food or steaming plastic cups. A wide assortment of weapons that she could not identify hung off their belts, along with some odd knives, the blades having a strange blue tint, almost as if lake water had been solidified hard as rock. Even more strange, the women also carried weapons and were not chained in any manner that Liana could see, as if they were equals and not slaves. Trying not to make any noise, Liana eased a hand down her body and was startled to discover that she was fully dressed. The unseen garments were as soft as the clothing of a baron, and there was something on her feet even more comfortable than a pair of deerskin moccasins. The spare denim pants and sneakers had come from Mildred, the socks and shirt from Christy. The clothing was a little tight in some spots and a tad baggy in others, but it was still the finest clothing she had ever worn. Surreptitiously, she examined between her legs, but there was no pain or soreness, not even dried blood. Clearly, she had not been taken while unconscious. Liana looked about at the cave, but the only opening was past the 5 cold hearts, and partially blocked by a large boulder and an odd arrangement of torn bushes lashed together into a crude curtain. Was that done to keep out the night flyers who lived in caves? Oh, very clever.
Ah, I see you're finally awake. I was hoping that the smell of food would bring you around. Hunger is one of the most powerful of the primordial triggers. How's your head? Feeling any better?
Uh-huh.
Hope you don't mind, but we took all the snakes. Didn't want food going to waste.
Fresh snake. Been a long time. One of my faves.
You want some food? Or coffee? It's not coffee sub either, but the real stuff from a pre-dark tin.
I've never met a singer before. That's a mighty valuable talent.
Please don't kill me. I'm not a mutie. I'm not. I found those snakes. Honest.
From sheer force of habit, Liana reached up to touch her face and found that her hair had been combed to the sides. These newcomers could see her eyes. They knew the truth. The terror on Liana's face was plain for everyone to see, and the companions could easily guess the reasons why. There had to be a rat crater in the area, and for decades, children had been born horribly malformed. Over time, any deviation from the norm would be unclean, maybe even blasphemous, and more than sufficient justification for being killed on the spot, even newborn babes.
Calm down. We know that you're not a mutie.
You do?
Shit, fire. You think I'm a mutie just because of my skin?
No, of course not, Master.
Now you cut that shit out right now. Nobody here is a baron or a sec man. We're just people, same as you.
Dear God, girl, do people think you're a mutie because you're of Asian descent? I mean, your eyes. Do folks believe you're a mutie because of how your eyes are shaped and the color of your skin?
Yes.
Oh, shit. Double whole shit. Just part Japanese or Chinese or somethingese. I seen hunters like you. Nothing special.
Really?
Sure.
Where did you see them, sir?
All over the Deathlands. Front Royal, Tucsonville, Hammertown, New Orleans, Iron Hat, near the Washington Hole.
I don't know any of those vills. Where in the world are they?
So, what vill are you from?
I was born in the Wildwoods. Never even seen the inside of a vill.
Yeah, me too. By the way, don't you want your stuff?
Stuff?
There on your right.
Liana looked down. Lying on a clean piece of white cloth was her beloved flute, as well as a sheathed knife, a crossbow, and a quiver of arrows.
Your share of stuff from chilling the cold hearts. You're not a slave or our new slut or any damn thing else. If you want to leave, there's the door.
We won't stop you. You have my word on that, little sister.
Oh, by the way, the name is J.B. Dix.
I'm Liana.
No last name?
Me? I'm no baron.
In short order, the rest of the introductions were exchanged as the woman strapped on her new weapons. The crossbow was as familiar as air to the woman, but the knife, she had never seen bone this hard and sharp. It shone bright like winter ice.
Well, it's time for me to go stand guard duty. See you in a couple of hours.
If you're hungry, there's still plenty of food. Mostly it's just snake, but we also have some rice mixed with canned veggies.
Eagerly scooting closer to the fire, Liana accepted a plate, marveling over the strange material it was made from, until the smell of the stew hit her. Then she dug in with gusto, using her fingers. Tactfully, the other said nothing about the nearby fork and spoon.
This is good.
Well, Liana, I'm very impressed with your ability. Have you always been able to summon snakes?
Sure, I've always been a singer.
Can you summon anything else?
I only ever needed snakes.
What about the fog? When does it clear?
Fog?
The stuff out there that looks like smoke.
You mean the air?
Ryan scowled. If the locals didn't even have a word for the fog, then it probably never went away. There had to be a rad crater or a volcano in the vicinity, boiling a section of the ocean into steam, creating a permanent shroud over the land. That was bad news. Without a clear view of the sun, JB would never be able to find out exactly where they were this time.
Do I smell coffee? Ah, I see that our guest has finally returned from the land of Nod. Welcome back, dear lady. I trust you are comfortable?
Fine. Yes, no damage.
Suddenly, Liana felt oddly naked. Even though she was fully dressed, the tall outlander affected her in the most disturbing way. He was very handsome, almost striking, and while the silver hair made him appear to be a wrinkly, this close, she could see that was wrong. The tall man carried himself with the assurance of a seasoned sec man, but there was something in his face that she could not readily define. Looking into his smiling eyes, Liana saw something that she had only known from her father, something she scarcely even had a word for. Kindness. Somehow she felt sure that this was a man who would never harm her, no matter what.
Doc, say hello to Liana. Miss Liana, may I present Dr. Theophilus Algernon Tanner?
Charmed, dear lady.
I saw what you did to those cold hearts. For some of the fight, anyway.
Indeed. Well, I'm always glad to assist a damsel in distress.
Oh, thank you.
Liana threw her arms around Doc's neck and hugged tight. Standing as if hit with a poleaxe, Doc did nothing for an inordinate length of time. Then, ever so slowly, the scholar placed his arms around the young woman and gently returned the gesture.
It's all right, my dear.
He held her as if he were afraid that something might break, and not necessarily the beautiful young woman in his arms. Once it had been the skull of a kraken, but now it was the terrible throne room of Ankerville. The mouth and eyes had been closed with stout wooden shutters, and the interior walls delicately carved with scenes of victorious battle, along with the legendary downfall of the pre-dark world. At this time of night, the throne room was normally full of people, sec-men, servants, and stewards, but by the command of the Baron, it had been completely emptied for a very special visitor. Standing uncomfortably in the palatial grandeur, the bearded hilly was dressed in badly cured furs. As a sign of goodwill, none of his stone weapons had been taken. However, both of the other people in the throne room were armed with working firearms.
Exactly how much metal are we talking here? A pound? 2 pounds?
My lady, more than the weight of a man.
How much? I should chill you on the spot for lying to my baron.
No, it's true. I watched the jacking from the bushes in the forest, planned on taking whatever was left behind. But I saw that the outlanders were covered with metal. All different kinds. There's metal in their backpacks, on their faces, around their necks, mixed into their clothing. And they had blasters like I never seen. I know it sounds crazy, but the thing shot faster than a dozen Imperial crossbows and spit out tiny gold pieces of metal that sparkled in the firelight.
These blasters. The golden pieces came out the bottom, right?
No! They popped out the sides. Kind of made an arch as they flew away.
How did they load them?
Shoved in little boxes. But first, they had to move some kind of stick on the top. Don't know what it did.
All right, little man, I'll pay your price. 50 horses, 50 slaves, 10 crossbows, and 100 arrows.
150?
Done. Now, tell me a little more about these outlanders. Tell me everything.
It was long after midnight before the thunder and lightning finally began to recede and the pounding rain stopped. Ryan was on guard duty inside the cave, sitting on a rock with the Steyr leaning against the nearby cave wall. The Sig Sauer was tucked into the holster of his gun belt, and he was testing the action on his new acquisition from the Navy ship, a Desert Eagle. The big bore weapon was a real hand cannon, the wide magazine holding only 7 fat 50-caliber rounds. The recoil would be awful, but anything hit by the weapon would probably be damn near blown in two. Unfortunately, there was only the one magazine of 7 rounds, so Ryan planned to save the hand cannon in case they returned to the ship. Setting aside the Desert Eagle, Ryan rose and grabbed the Steyr to check outside. The clouds were gone from overhead, and in the east, the sun was just starting to rise.
Oh, that's good to see.
Ryan went back inside the cave and hurried to JB. Lying right next to the armorer was the recently cleaned and oiled 9mm FN Herschel. The logo on the checkered Zytel grip marked it as the property of NATO, but what that was doing inside an American warship was anybody's guess.
Hey, Jibby, wake up.
Trouble?
Better. We've got Sky.
The morning air felt crisp and clean as a groggy JB sloshed across the sodden ground to reach the shore. Black storm clouds rumbled on the western horizon, but a glorious sun was rising in the east, a reddish sky brightening into dawn. Unfortunately, the ever-present cloud of toxic chems and rads was already starting to roll in from the south, and JB knew that he only had a few minutes to get this right. There would be no second chances. With Ryan standing nearby as protection, the armorer swung the mini-sextant to his eye. Expertly focusing it on the rising sun, he then carefully placed the mirrors and started working the numbers. A few moments later, the rest of the companions stumbled from the cave, their hands full of weapons and rolls of toilet paper. JB pulled a plastic-coated map from the munitions bag.
Okay. We are... Yep, we're on Royal Island in Lake Superior, smack between Canada and Michigan.
Oh, that's just a lake?
Well, technically it's a lake, but really it's an inland sea, hundreds of miles wide and over 1,000 feet deep in some spots.
Which would make it roughly the same size as England.
Pretty damn close.
Fire blast. There's no way we're ever going to paddle across that on a raft.
Not and survive. Now, Canada is to the north, and only a few miles away. However...
Travel in that direction is forbidden because of Red Mountain.
Adjusting his eye patch, Ryan scowled darkly. Red Mountain, that was the local name for what had to be a major volcano. Liana had told them about that after dinner. The volcano was huge, probably a series of volcanoes, the lava flow boiling the lake for several miles, and generating the eternal fog that was already starting to creep across the landscape once more. Oddly, Liana had also said that that was the direction that most of the muties on the island came from, and that anybody traveling toward the mountain soon died coughing blood with their hair falling out. That strongly indicated the chain of volcanoes was not a natural formation, but had been caused by Skydark. Red Mountain. A rad mountain was more likely, Ryan thought.
Not much of a choice here. Canada is closer, but unreachable. Which makes the only safe way to travel being south to Michigan.
Across 200 miles of open sea.
We either buy or steal a boat from some ville.
Only Anchor and North Point have boats large enough to carry 7 people.
Think they'd be interested in doing some trade?
Not North Point. They don't want anybody else to own boats. But Anchor might. The Baron is a fool.
That is where you formerly served as a slave?
No, I was a slave in the Wildwoods at North Point. But by now the birds have spread the word of my escape, and I'm worth a full pound of metal to any ville that takes me alive so that Baron Wainwright can strap me to the learning tree.
Then you'll just wait in the hills with everyone else until we return. If they think you're a mutie because of your eyes, they'll think the same thing about Christy and Jack.
There's nobody like them in any of the villes.
Nobody as good as, you mean.
And is there anybody like me?
There's plenty of women in the ville.
Never mind.
Mildred smiled. If the girl didn't even understand the question, then her skin color would not be a problem.
Anybody there wear spectacles like these?
No, I have never seen glass eyes before.
I guess I'm staying in the hills, too. I'm not blind yet without them, but near enough to matter in a fight.
Besides, we'll need to keep watch in case Ryan and Mildred get into trouble. Always have to prepare for the worst, as Doc likes to say.
Hope for the best, but prepare for the worst. Ben Franklin was a very wise man.
You want me to help guard him? The big man with the eye patch?
Anybody can get captured. Besides, we never divide the group unless absolutely necessary. Those cold hearts could have friends. Left here alone, you'd be easy pickings for them. Best to keep everybody together.
At the very least, you will need to show us where the ville is located.
I can do that easy.
Any good with that crossbow?
In a blur, the woman turned and fired, the arrow flashing past Jack. A split second later, a squirrel dropped out of the branches of a pine tree to land twitching on the ground, directly through the head.
That'll do.
Breakfast before anything else. Empty bellies make empty minds.
Well, it's my turn to cook. Is there any of the stew left?
Nope.
Fair enough. How use some of the MRE packs?
I'd be glad to help. I'm a very good cook.
Me too. This time you watch, learn how we do things. Then you can make lunch. Fair enough?
Done and done.
Leaving the cave behind, the companions trundled inland, going high into the foothills, then across a woodsy glen. As the day progressed, the thick fog returned, masking the landscape until it was impossible to see more than a few yards in any direction. To Ryan's irritation, he realized that this condition made the scope of his stire useless. Any killing on Royal Island would be up close and personal. Preparing to bargain with a local baron, Ryan and Mildred had already removed anything they carried that was made of metal, belt buckles, rad counter, belt knives and such, including their combat boots. The footwear wasn't made of metal, but it was in far too good shape. The spare army blankets had been converted into crude ponchos, held in place by pieces of hemp rope, with additional pieces lashed into place around their bare feet as crude rag boots. Doc said the idea came from the Middle Ages. Trying to look the role of Sekhman from one of the outer islands, both Ryan and Mildred were armed with a crossbow and quiver, stone knives, wooden boomerang, and bolo. However, secreted inside their shirts, under their ponchos, were their guns and a few grens, just in case of emergencies. The two companions also carried a couple of gifts for the Baron, hopefully more than enough to buy a boat and fishing nets. The companions had no conceivable use for the nets, but since it was forbidden to leave the island, they would make for a good cover story, as Mildred liked to say. A reasonable lie, used to hide the uncomfortable truth. The companions climbed a ragged hill covered with pine trees, only to quickly go around a small bay, the rad counters of Ryan and JB both clicking steadily upward.
That's Dead Man Bay. It looks safe, but drink that water or even eat a fish from there, and all your hair falls out. Then you start bleeding from the gums.
And then?
And then the Sekhmen shovel dirt over you. They used to feed the bodies to the crabs, but then the women started having bad babies for some reason, so the Baron made them stop.
Crabs eat the corpse, then you eat the crabs?
Sure, why?
Phew, that the reason.
Heavy metal poisoning.
Strontium, thulium, cobalt, the list of lethal isotopes was nearly endless. Mildred thought it most likely that the bay had been hit by a Russian MIRV, a warhead containing not a single massive thermonuclear bomb, but a dozen tactical nukes.
Are you a white coat?
Healer. Just a healer.
The masked sun was in the afternoon sky by the time the companions started to run across traces of the ville. Repairs done to the dirt road from the damages of the summer rains, acres of tree stumps with the splintery stumps giving mute testimony to the backbreaking task of using a stone axe, and a crude bridge spanning a dry ravine that was probably a raging torrent in the spring. Finding a relatively secluded area, masked from the surrounding hills by a copse of maple trees, Ryan and Mildred divested themselves of their larger metal items, the spare weapons and brass going to Jack, the stire to Christy, and the med kit to Doc. Double-checking each other for anything metallic, Ryan and Mildred then rubbed some loose dirt into their hair and clothing to enhance the idea that they had walked to anchor from the far end of the known world.
Okay, we part company here. Whether we get a boat or not, we'll meet you at the grotto that Liana told us about.
We'll be there. And if you're not back by midnight, we'll come looking for you.
Damn well better.
Watch out for the Wendigo.
What?
The Wendigo. It's a terrible machine on wheels.
Why is it called the Wendigo?
Unless I'm mistaken, that comes from a Canadian myth about an unstoppable monster. A trapper went mad from hunger, ate a friend, and the Indian gods cursed him forever.
Unstoppable monster. Good name for a war-wag.
Hopefully it's just marketing, not an accurate description.
As the companion slipped into the bushes, Jack waited until they were past before following along behind, a leafy branch in his pale hands erasing any trace of their passage.
A trader used to do something similar with sage bushes. Said he learned it from the Sioux when he was a kid. Seems kind of funny thinking of the trader that way, learning things instead of teaching others.
Even the great Socrates had a teacher as a child.
You sound like Doc.
When the others were completely out of sight, Ryan and Mildred stolidly returned to the main road, then walked back toward the lake for a mile, before turning and starting for the ville again. Along the way, they sharply watched the trees and hillsides for any signs of perimeter guards, sentries, or outriders, but saw only songbirds, stingwings, and an abundance of squirrels. Whatever else was wrong with the island, at least food was plentiful, which was a nice change from the vast, sterile deserts of the Western Deathlands. A few miles later, the ville rose into view. Situated on the side of a cliff, the walls were composed of irregularly shaped stones joined with a blue material that was probably river clay. Sekhmet women armed with crossbows walked along the top of the structure, and a guard tower rose high above the vill. The pillbox on top bristled with wooden spears like a frightened porcupine.
Protection from the Kraken Liana mentioned?
Perhaps.
The front gate of the vill was made of interlocking logs, the bark stripped off and the smooth bare wood studded with wooden spikes and shiny pieces of volcanic glass. Only the hinges seemed to be made of metal. Then Ryan looked again. Two of the six hinges were metal, the rest were carved from stone. Unlike every other vill Ryan and Mildred had ever encountered, the front gate was wide open, with no guards in sight. However, there was another log wall just past the gate, neatly blocking any view of the vill. That was standard in most vills. The second wall was a shatter zone, designed to break the charge of any invaders and to give the vill Sekhmet an excellent place to shoot at the enemy from relative safety. Strolling closer, Ryan could hear the sounds of vill life. When they were only a few yards away, a Sekhmet scrambled out of a brick kiosk, holding a large crossbow. Each brick in the kiosk was a different color, showing that they had been salvaged from several ruins, and there was a firing slit in the side. Subtle movements on the other side showing that the gatekeeper was not alone. The guard looked dangerous, but Mildred was relieved at the sight of the large black man, his skin even darker than her own. Once more, Liana was right. Mildred was just regular folks here. The Sekhmet was dressed in thick furs, with a stone throwing axe hanging from a thong at his side.
Hold it there, Outlanders!
Sure thing.
What's your biz in Anchor?
Just here to buy a boat.
Buy a boat? What for? They're easy enough to make out of bark.
Don't want a fragging canoe, we need a fishing boat. A big one. Got a whole vill to feed. And mine got swept out to sea in a storm last week.
Along with our master carpenter. You ever try to make one of those things without any tools?
Hell no, and don't ever want to try either. Well, come on in. Guess you're telling the truth. We do have the best carpenters in the world. A man can notch that into his crossbow.
Everybody knows that flies straight. Is there a toll?
Toll?
We heard from a North Point Sekhmet that folks had to give the payment of a good arrow to get into anchor. We thought it was a lie, of course, but still
those
we...
dirty, inbred, nudie-kissing sons of bitches. No, there ain't no nuke and toll. Never even heard of such a triple crazy thing before.
You know North Point.
You got that right, friend. Welcome to anchor. No riding a slave unless you ask permission first. Knife fights ain't allowed in the Gaudy House, only bare fist. Piss in the lake, not the street, or else you get 10 lashes, 20 for lying to a Sekhmet, 50 lashes for refusing to obey a direct order. Savvy?
No prob. Where would we find the Baron anyway?
Don't worry about that. He'll find you.
Nice accent, by the way.
It's magically delicious.
Say what?
Never mind.
The guard went back into the kiosk. Ambling through the gate and around the shatter zone, the two companions were instantly immersed into a living mandala of noise, smoke, and motion. The air was redolent with the smells of baking bread, frying fish, horse dung, and boiling laundry. The perfume of civilization. Civvies and Sekhmet were everywhere, each going in a different direction, and children ran underfoot. Sitting around in clusters, elders nimbly stitched repairs to ripped fishing nets. In the open doorway of a log cabin, a beautiful young woman with an infant suckling at her breast was stirring a cauldron of bubbling maple syrup, the aroma so sweet to the companions that it was almost sickening. Crystallized sticks of maple candy hung from the eaves. At another cabin, a man was diligently smearing fresh mud along a wide split in a seam. The busy vill was alive with commerce, and nobody paid attention to Mildred and Ryan as they strolled along, which was just fine by them. The less they were noticed, the better. However, Mildred secretly reveled in the commotion. Any kind of civilization was better than none. Then the physician saw the dreaded learning tree, the wooden stocks and wide leather straps darkly seasoned with overlapping bloodstains, and she quickly revised her opinion.
Found it!
Ryan began moving quickly in a new direction. Lurching forward, Mildred rushed to stay close as Ryan slipped into the bustling crowd and disappeared from sight. Down in the bowels of the Harrington, the ceiling lights sluggishly flickered several times, then they came back on, filling the engine room with a blinding corona of power. Surveying the assorted wreckage to the main engine and primary tokamak power reactor, the sectroid made a command decision. Several small hatches opened in the armored chassis of the machine, and out rushed a score of small repair robots. Resembling mechanical spiders, the robots looked at the massive damage and started to rush forward, when the sectroid issued an electronic command to override their programming. Pausing for only a nanosecond to digest the new information, the robots changed direction to converge on the auxiliary power plant. Crawling over the hulking machine, they conducted a preliminary assessment, noting every nick and ding, then patiently waited until the sectroid gave them permission to start the repairs. Instantly, their dozens of small lasers pulsed into life, cutting away the dented access panels. As one of the heavy pieces of shielding came loose, the robots scuttled inside and crawled everywhere, measuring, testing, and probing to finally analyze the internal damage. The sectroid waited patiently for their detailed report. Soon enough, power would be restored to the entire vessel. Then it would immediately turn the power back off, making the Harrington appear to be dead once more, a helpless prey for the invaders. When they eventually returned, the power would come crashing back on, and every hatch would slam shut, trapping them inside. That was when the sectroid would attack. The invaders would be confused and frightened, easy prey for the military juggernaut. However, if for some unknown reason it seemed that the invaders might destroy the droid and seize control of the vessel, it would have no choice but to detonate the scuttling charges hidden inside the keel of the carrier. Either way, win, lose, or draw, the Matrans would never fall into the hands of the enemy. With supreme patience, the machine began to run a systems check on its various weapon systems. Everything was under control. Now, it was only a matter of time. The fog was heavy along the shore, and with their crossbows leading the way, the North Point Sekmen warily pushed aside the curtain of thorny bushes to enter the dark cave. The last to enter was the Hilly, the mountain man brandishing a weapon in each hand, his every sense alert for the presence of the one-eyed giant who led the pack of outlanders. As the Sekmen moved deeper into the cave, their torches revealed nobody hidden inside the rocky passageway, only the remains of an abandoned campsite, a few broken arrows, and some food scraps.
Well, whatever that shit is, there's no big honking pile of blasters waiting for us, that's for damn sure. I always did think that inbred throwback was shitting in our ears.
No! I swear the Outlanders were here!
Shut the fuck up, or you get your ass beaten!
No need for that yet.
Sec Chief LaFontaine paused to retrieve something shiny from the cold ashes of the campfire. At first, he couldn't quite identify what it was, never having seen anything like it before. Then his mind coalesced around the object. It was a spoon, a bent spoon made of solid metal, left behind with the trash, as if it was of no importance whatsoever, completely worthless.
Release him. He was telling it straight, boys. The Outlanders were here, and packing more steel than even the Lord High Bastard Griffin, his own damn self.
So what are we waiting for? Let's go track down the Mutiny Lovers and get those blasters!
LaFontaine led the way outside to the waiting horses. Climbing onto his mount, the Sec Chief shook the reins and started forward at a slow walk.
All right! I want a full wreck of the beach. They probably swept the dirt to disguise which direction they went in, but nobody can do that forever. Spread out! Find their damn tracks, and it's a week of beef, bed, and beer for the man who does!
The Sec Man burst into eager smiles at that. Expressions changed as a mountain of mottled hide rose from the nearby lake, the colossal figure of the Kraken blotting out the foggy sun. The Sekmen swung up their crossbows to cut loose with a flurry of arrows. They hit the Muti hard, the wooden shafts going in up to the fletching. The monstrous thing ignored the attack, its tentacles snaking out of the waves to grab a horse by the legs. The struggling animal was hauled into the lake and disappeared beneath the choppy surface.
Retreat!
LaFontaine kicked his horse in the flanks and charged for the nearby forest. Galloping off the beach, the North Point Sekmen raced for their lives. If they could just get deep enough into the trees, the sheer size of the Muti would prevent it from following. Oddly, the Hilly did nothing, standing motionless near the mouth of the cave, a hand covering his mouth. Astonished, LaFontaine and the Sekmen had no idea what the idiot was doing and didn't care. If the Hilly wanted to see a Kraken from the inside, that was his choice, but they were going to live. bent over their animals, trying to urge them to greater speed. The Sec Chief and his troops were near the tree line when suddenly they were engulfed in writhing tentacles. Indiscriminately, random-entered horses were grabbed and bodily dragged back to the lake, then were hauled below the waves and out of sight. Reaching the forest, the surviving Sec men slowed their advance to keep from getting knocked from their horses by the endless array of low-hanging branches.
Think we're safe now? I would say not.
A mottled tentacle had lifted the Sec man out of the saddle and into the sky. LaFontaine reined his horse to a halt under a large oak tree and slipped out of the saddle. Stepping away from the animal, he covered his mouth with a hand and tried not to breathe too loudly. With his heart pounding in his chest, the Sec chief burned to tell the others what to do, but knew that would only mean his own demise. They had to figure it out on their own or die.
What the fuck are you doing, sir?
As comprehension dawned, the few remaining Sec men brought their horses to a standstill and clambered off to creep away from the animals as quietly as possible. Set free, the horses bolted deeper into the forest, and one by one, to their deaths, as they were hauled back toward the lake. Only a few seconds later, the Sec men were alone in the dim forest. Nobody dared to move or speak for an inordinate length of time. Then, a new sound began to permeate the woods. Looking curiously around, the Sec men saw the deadly tentacles of a kraken wiggling along the mossy ground, the questing tip probing every tree, rock, and bush in an orderly search for the hidden food.